from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Bocelli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll find out that there's more than just love at the Robert Indiana exhibit at the IMA.
I'll check out some of the upcoming festivals at the Indiana State Museum.
And I'll talk with composer James Aikman about his commission for the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra, and we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? All that and more right after the latest news from NPR. If I say Robert Indiana, you probably say love. But there's more to the iconic popular artist than that ubiquitous image. The Indianapolis Museum of Art is mounting the first print retrospective of Indiana's work in more than 40 years. And Sharon Gamble asked longtime IMA curator Martin Krause to come in to tell us about the man behind the love.
All right, so we have to start with Robert Indiana's name. He was not born with the name Robert Indiana, although he was born in Indiana.
Correct.
And he
Robert
lived
Clark.
And he lived like 21 different cities and towns in Indiana, or
well, most
something
of the,
crazy like
21
that.
Different addresses in the Indianapolis metropolitan area.
Really?
Before the age of 17. His mother was sort of a vagabond and was always looking to move, so they packed up and moved
regularly
times before he graduated from high school.
Oh, imagine the resettling into a, well, maybe not a new school each of those times, but.
Well, he said that's where his fascination with numbers came from, was the number of different addresses and house number one and house number two and house number three.
Oh, for heaven's sakes.
And so that's what he credits that particular fascination.
Man, you know, smart artists turn lemons into lemonade,
uh-huh.
Don't they? Man. And his parents divorced in a time earlier in the last century when that was still sort of uncommon.
Yeah, they split in 1938, though they both continued, at least for a while, to reside in Indianapolis. In fact, because Robert Clark at that point, wanted to attend Arsenal Technical High School because it had such a first-rate art department.
Really?
That he moved in with his father because his father lived within the district and his mother did not. Now, ultimately, his mother then moved within the district and he moved back with his mother. But at that point in the 40s, Tech had a bigger art faculty than Heron did. So it was – there were 14 full-time art teachers at Tech. It was a huge school, obviously.
I knew there was a big drafting program, but I didn't know that about the visual.
It was huge. And
that's amazing.
There was one teacher in particular, Sarah Bard, who many, many Indiana artists sort of started with, who must have been crackerjack. And she was just inspirational to a lot of up-and-coming artists in Indianapolis. I mean, Garo Antresian, who also went on to great fame, first at Heron and then elsewhere, was a pupil of Sarah Bard. And a number of the Tech students who went out to work with Disney in the mid-30s were also Sarah Bard students. And I've known several people who were students of hers, and they said she was absolutely a wonderful teacher.
Now, was she a hands-on artist herself?
Absolutely.
And
I think that
was... Do you have some of her works in your
collection? We actually do. We have a couple of watercolors by her in the collection.
Huh.
And in those days, before sort of accreditation, they would hire professionals to teach professional courses.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they would hire a novelist to teach creative writing,
right,
or they would hire a practicing artist to teach art. And so none of these people had education degrees. They were just professional practitioners of their craft.
It's what goes around comes around. The chain of colleges, the Art Institute of fill in the city name, does the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
They kind of bypass the teaching credentials part and say, we want hands-on professionals to teach you your
right.
craft.
That was, and I think in many cases there were probably wonderful teachers who could no longer teach because they didn't have the academic credentials.
Right.
But you know, for the high school or the institute to be accredited, they had to. So there was a huge changeover, and I think that happened in the 60s.
At what point did Robert Indiana change his name?
In 1958. And there are various reasons for that. The first and foremost was that he thought that Clark was just too boring a name and that no artist worth the salt would become famous with the name Robert Clark.
Huh.
So he changed it to Robert Indiana. This was after he had arrived in New York. He'd been there actually 4 years by then. And I think Tennessee Williams was sort of in the ascendancy, so that was the specific inspiration.
Oh.
But because he was an historian as well, he knew that all those Renaissance artists were named for their regions or their towns.
Right.
Leonardo da Vinci, Pietro da Cortona, people like that. So there was a tradition there that he just sort of adopted. And so he's been Robert Indiana ever since.
Anybody criticize him? Did he get any pushback for that?
Not that I know of.
Yeah.
You'd have to ask him,
I guess.
But right. I didn't have the presence of mind to ask him that question.
Well, and we might have the chance you mentioned before we actually started our official interview that you're used to working with dead artists who don't necessarily have opinions. And this has been maybe a little bit of a treat and a little bit of a change of pace for you working with a live artist.
It's been a pleasure because Robert Indiana's mellowed over time. So he's really been very congenial and very good to work with. But he does have his opinions on things.
Sure.
And, you know, I presented him with sort of the checklist for the exhibition, which were, all screen prints that had something to do with the autobiographical nature of his work.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, we should put some numbers in there. And I said, well, the numbers don't really have as much to do with autobiography as the pieces I've chosen. And I said, the catalog is already at the printer, so we really can't change it at that point. But that didn't stop him from asking. So.
Good for him.
But all in all, it was a delightful experience to work with what is – you know, sort of now the dean of the pop artists.
Absolutely.
And I've known of him for many, many years. And one of the first exhibitions I saw when I came to the Indianapolis Museum of Art in 1977 was the retrospective of his paintings that we held the next year.
Right.
So that goes back 36 years now.
Wow. So he got this great start at Arsenal Technical High School. Went up to Chicago to the Art Institute.
Correct.
And then did what was still sort of expected of American artists, went abroad,
mm-hmm.
went to Edinburgh
yes.
to study.
That was he was, I guess, the School of the Art Institute did not have academic courses associated with it. So you had to go someplace else to get sort of the requisite academics for your BFA.
Mm.
And he chose to go to Edinburgh. And he wrote poetry while he was there, and he sort of typesetted himself, which sort of got him. He always had a sort of a literary bent, which is probably why words became so important to him. And when he was in the service from 1946 to 49, basically his jobs at various bases was working on the base newspapers. And actually, he had worked for the Star briefly, but I think more as a gopher when he was in high school. So I think he always had that side to him that was interested in language, and that sort of manifested the sort of combination between art and literature manifested itself first at Edinburgh when he started typesetting his poems.
So if people know nothing else about his work, they know the love, the
right.
iconic love. Sculpture, but can you tell us how did he become? Obviously, as you just said, he was attracted to words, and it sounds like he was in a position in some of his jobs to come in close contact with typesetting and have that kind of physical relationship with type and with letters. But his works are so bold, and where did that inspiration come from?
Well, it was sort of a combination of things. when he was in New York, his first studio was on Coenties Slip, which was on the East River, just down from the Brooklyn Bridge. And Ellsworth Kelly, the sort of minimalist painter, also had a studio on the Slip. And Ellsworth Kelly, who had slightly older than Robert Indiana and had just come back from fairly lengthy study in Europe, became Robert Indiana's mentor.
Huh.
So Robert Indiana began sort of threw aside the figurative tradition in which he had been trained and began painting these sort of very Kelly-esque abstractions, flat colors, flat primary colors.
Hmm.
And then when he began to insert words into them, Kelly wasn't happy with them, so they split because Kelly was sort of a purist as far as the geometric shapes that he painted.
Sure.
So that, and I think that Robert Indiana has just sort of an innate color sense, which he understands how certain combinations of colors vibrate. And if you think of the Love painting, whose basic palette is red, green, and blue, he knew that sort of red and green were the most electric colors on his palette, as mm-hmm. he called it. But there was another reason that he chose those colors, which is really at the root of the exhibition, that for most people, and myself included, you look at his paintings and you see them as sort of graphic and rather superficial. I mean, what's on the surface is fairly simple. But there's always something from his past or from memories embedded in the paintings.
Hmm.
And in the case of the Love painting, it was something that went back to his boyhood, that his father worked for Phillips 66 in an office at 38th and College. And Robert Indiana and his mother would drive him to work every morning. And there was a big Phillips 66 sign out front, which was, at that time, their logo colors were red and green. So this fixed itself in his mind. And when his father died in 1965, and he was on the cusp of painting these Love paintings, that was the color that he chose as sort of a memorial to his father.
Oh.
So the red and the green of Love on blue is the red and green of the Phillips 66 sign against the blue Indiana sky.
Oh.
So you wouldn't know that unless he told you.
Right.
But almost all of his work is autobiographical in that way. And over the past 4 years, we've spent a lot of time talking about what is embedded in the in his paintings, and he's written quite a bit on it recently. But in the 1960s, nobody really knew that because he wasn't telling anybody that.
Sure, and people.
So their initial reaction to him was that, well, his work looks like that of the pop artists.
Right, right.
But there's a certain commercial root in his work, which
right.
is true because his basic inspiration came from sign painting, but none of his work really had to do with consumerism like Andy Warhol's soup cans or Roy Lichtenstein's exploded cartoon panels.
Mm-hmm.
His work was always very personal, so he never quite understood why he was
lumped in
with
those.
The pop
sure.
artists, even though he was close friends with a goodly number of them. There was no sort of group consciousness or anything. So I think he's reconciled himself to the fact that he will forever be considered a pop artist at this point.
But sounds like this show is going to help change that.
Yeah, well, it's the fascinating thing to me was decoding his work. And that is really sort of integral to the exhibition itself. And I found that very interesting, so I hope that the visitors find that
sure.
interesting as well, because there is a layer underneath these rather anonymous surfaces of his paintings. Now, obviously, my exhibition is screen prints, his original prints.
Right.
But there's often a one-to-one relationship between his prints and his paintings. So a retrospective of his prints, which is what we're doing,
mm-hmm.
Is a quasi-retrospective of his most important painted works. And hence the title, The Essential Robert Indiana, for the exhibition, because it's sort of the canon of major Robert Indiana images from 1960 to 2009.
Do you have a favorite piece
Oh, that's always difficult to say. There's a group that is lesser known done in the 90s, which I find absolutely breathtaking. And he did a series of homages to the American abstract painter Marsden Hartley, who was active in the teens. Mm-hmm. And these so-called Hartley elegies are spring from the sort of abstracted portraits that Marsden Hartley painted. And by portraits, I mean he would take, in particular, a portrait of a German officer that he did in 1914, who had been a friend of his by the name of Karl von Freiberg, who had died in the first days of the First World War. Mm-hmm. Instead of painting a portrait of von Freiberg, Hartley took sort of bits of military regalia that had been parts of his uniform and painted them, epaulettes and the Iron Cross, which he had just won, and flags in the background that all sort of spoke to this person. And Robert Indiana sort of works in the same way. He doesn't paint figurative portraits. He does sort of symbolic portraits. So there was a natural kinship there between what Hartley was doing in 1914 and what Indiana was doing, you know, 70 or 80 years later. But the kicker was that Hartley was from Maine. And, of course, once Robert Indiana had moved to Maine, there was this connection between the two artists. And these sorts of coincidences have always been motivational to Robert Indiana, that he finds this not only intriguing but sort of inspirational. And Marsden Hartley had actually spent one summer on the island of Vinylhaven, where Robert Indiana lived.
Which is where he lives, yeah.
And so it was a natural connection for him to make. And these screen prints, there are 10 of them, they're about 6 feet tall. They're enormous.
Wow.
And just absolutely dazzling in terms of color. They're not typical of Robert Indiana, if you're familiar with basically the love sculpture or the love painting and what he was doing in the 1960s. But on the other hand, they are sort of unmistakably Robert Indiana because they still have that same hard-edged primary color compositions. And so there's a certain evolution in his work, which is natural and which occurred over the past 50 years. But yet these are quite different because their inspiration was not so much in that case his own personal autobiography, but Marsden Hartley paintings.
Yeah.
Even though he sort of merges those with his own psyche.
Sharon Gamble and IMA curator Martin Krause. You can see The Essential Robert Indiana from this Sunday through May 4th at the IMA. Learn more at imamuseum.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio. The Indiana State Museum has lots going on this month, including two upcoming festivals, the Indiana Art Fair this weekend and the GeoFest next weekend. Travis DiNicola spoke with Carrie Miller, Manager of Public Programs, to find out more.
Carrie, welcome to Art of the Matter. Great to have you here today.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. There's so much going on at the State Museum in February and a lot of events coming up. I know you just had the Sankofa Black Heritage Festival, and then you've got the Art Fair coming up and GeoFest. Where do we even start?
Well, I can start by saying that Sankofa was a great festival that kicked off our triple weekend of events. And so now we are switching gears and getting ready for the art fair that kicks off on preview night this Friday, February 14th.
Excellent. Great way to spend Valentine's.
I think so. And with Valentine's night at the art fair preview night, you'll be entertained with live music from the Indie String Quartet. There will be hors d'oeuvres and drinks available, and not to mention the reason for coming to mm-hmm. look at all that beautiful art that will be available.
Now, you guys have done this for a couple years now, having an art fair at the State Museum in sort of midwinter, kind of set up mainly in that sort of the large lobby where the Robert Indiana piece is, right?
Yes. That's level one of the museum. So we have several artists that will be located down near, as you mentioned, the Robert Indiana Obelisk. And then we will also have several artists located up on level two, around the public spaces and within our Oscar C. McCullough School number 5.
Oh, cool. Okay. Now, and these are all Indiana artists, Indiana-based, or some sort of connection?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Our one requirement for participating in the Indiana Art Show is that you be an Indiana resident. And so we have 62 artists representing 23 counties from around the state.
Very cool. And quite a wide variety. I mean, just from in past years, I know it's been everything from more, there could be ceramics, photographs, abstract paintings, landscapes. I mean, really quite a mix.
Oh, you certainly hit the nail on the head. Ceramics. Fiber art, which can be both decorative or wearable. Mm-hmm. Recycled art, wood, painting, photography, jewelry, and mixed media.
Oh, cool. Excellent. So quite a great mix of art there. And, of course, the artists will be there, sort of like an indoor art fair, if you will, which
Absolutely.
Is kind of nice in the winter, a little bit better in the winter.
With these temperatures, yes. just bundle up to get in the car and then come on in. The museum has underground parking available, so you may enter the museum. From the safety of the cold weather.
It's good to keep in mind, actually.
Especially since our art fair kicks off on a Friday night, so it's from 5:30 to 8, and then again on Saturday, 10 a.m. to 5.
Very cool. And again, the Friday night event, that's a great thing for Valentine's Day. Do people need to make reservations for that?
It is recommended if you do so. You may call the museum at 317-232-1637. And the admission for the preview night is $20 per member, $25 per non-member.
Mm-hmm.
And if you attend on Friday night and didn't get a chance to see it all because you were just having a fabulous time, it's all right. You may bring your Friday night ticket with you Saturday to redeem it for free admission.
Oh, cool. Then get back in and then check out more of the art?
Absolutely.
Excellent. How do the artists, how are they selected? Is it adjudicated, first come, first serve? I mean, different Indiana artists that are just sort of, I know a number of them are repeaters who've been a part of it in the past.
We have a number of applications that respond to our call out, and we do our call out in August.
Mm-hmm.
And from the call out announcement from August to October, we keep everyone's application on file and we start the sorting process of what categories we will be hosting within the museum. We work with the community to acquire 5 jurors who then view the pictures or the images that the artist sent with their application, and all applications are scored. And then from there, we obtain our 62 artists.
Very cool. Very good. I imagine Mark Rushman has a bit to say about that now since he's working there at the State Museum.
Mark has been a great assistance to me in acquiring the jurors.
Mm-hmm. So, very good, very good. Now, let's talk about the GeoFest. This sounds pretty cool. This is a really interesting event you guys are doing. It's a annual fossil, gem, and mineral show, and I have not been to this, so tell me all about it.
Oh, my goodness. It is so huge that it is 3 days. It is Friday, Saturday, and Sunday with over 20 vendors.
Mm-hmm.
And these vendors are not just within Indiana. They are from all over the country that come and showcase, as you mentioned, fossils, rocks, gems, and minerals.
Mm-hmm.
And so whether you are into collecting fossils or gemstones, you want to come and view the jewelry that's for sale, there's a little bit of something for everybody. So rock hounds, jewelers, come and see what we have available.
It's a pretty popular hobby that people, it seems like I've been seeing a lot more about gems and rock shows and interest, especially in fossils as well.
Oh, absolutely. And the festival also gives us a chance to showcase the museum's fossil collection as well. And
we
currently have the exhibition Ice Age Giants, The Mysteries of Mammoths and Mastodons, which talks about all our fossils from mammoths and mastodons. And so we tied that exhibition in with GeoFest. GeoFest is presented by IMI, Irving Materials Incorporated, and they are even featured in the Ice Age Giant exhibition because we've found fossils at one of their quarry sites. So,
oh, very cool.
The exhibition, IMI, and GeoFest all go hand in hand.
So I mean, you guys have some pretty cool stuff going on. I mean, just all the time, including, as you mentioned, of course, the mammoths and now the Ice Age exhibit. Tell me about some of the other stuff going on, because, I mean, it sounds like a great weekend to, you know, you could come down to the GeoFest and then also see what else is going on that's just on regular exhibit at the State Museum.
Currently, you will also be able to see Fearless Furniture.
Right. That exhibit is still on. In fact, Mark Rushman was in talking about that just a while back on Art of the Manor.
Yes, indeed. And we certainly have our level 1 and level 2 core galleries. If you haven't had a chance to peruse those, level 2 is focused all about our cultural history in Indiana, mm-hmm. and level 1 is our natural history.
Very cool. And then I do have to ask you, though, because there's been just so much excitement about your big woolly mammoth. Can you tell me about him a bit?
Fred,
yeah.
Yes. Fred is our mastodon.
Mastodon, excuse me.
It's all right. We actually
don't tell Fred that I got him confused with a woolly mammoth.
Fred is a mastodon, and so we talk about and showcase within mm-hmm. the exhibition, when you're looking at these bones, these fossils, how do you tell the difference? So going through the exhibition shows you how you can be a paleontologist and what to look for. You're looking at tusks, you're looking at teeth, and those are the best two ways to tell the difference between the two.
I'm just thinking, you know, when I was a kid, I was so fascinated by fossils and such. And what a great thing. I can imagine, like, you know, a 10-year-old, you know, boy or girl going through there and checking out the exhibit and then getting a chance to go to the GeoFest and actually take some stuff home with them, which makes it even cooler.
Absolutely. GeoFest isn't just for collectors. It is for educational as well. Mm-hmm. And so you could come through, participate in our activity stations to learn a little bit more about fossils, rocks, and gemstones. And minerals, and get a couple of take-homes as well when you visit those activity stations. So we're definitely making sure that not only did you see beautiful fossils, rocks, or gemstones, but that you get to take a little bit of something home with you and hopefully learn something than you didn't when you arrived.
Carrie, you sound like you're a fan of the gemstones and fossils yourself. Are you?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, I can tell.
Very
I can
much
tell.
So,
yeah?
Yes.
Yeah, so you're looking forward to this show, certainly.
I look forward to it every year.
Do you have any personal favorites, or gemstones or fossils, or
I like the fossils, mm-hmm. and I generally walk away with some piece of jewelry every year.
Certainly understandable. Hey, before I let you go, because I mean, there's so much obviously going on in February at the State Museum, but anything you can give us a little heads up on and coming up later this spring.
In our level 3 changing galleries, mm-hmm. yes, this spring we'll be featuring an exhibition, a traveling exhibition that will be coming called NASA Destination Station that will be focusing on the International Space Station.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. That sounds great. We'll hear more about that as we get closer to that. Carrie, thank you so much for coming in. Art of Man, it's great to hear what's going on at the Indiana State Museum.
Thank you for having me.
Travis DiNicola with the State Museum's Manager of Public Programs, Carrie Miller. The Indiana Art Fair takes place on February 14th and 15th, and the GeoFest from the 21st through the 23rd. More information is at indianamuseum.org, indianamuseum.org. Hey, Travis.
Yes, Sharon.
So it's the big weekend, the weekend of love, not just because of the Robert Indiana exhibit at the IMA.
Though that has something to do with
it. Yeah,
it
really does. Mm-hmm. But also because if you're hearing us Thursday night, you might be out there scrambling for a last-minute Valentine's gift idea.
No.
Or maybe you met your true love on Valentine's Day and now it's Saturday morning and you're thinking, I need to get that special someone something.
Still time.
Right. We have lots of ideas on our calendar we call.
What do we do for Valentine's Day? And beyond. Okay, I'm just going to put this one out there right now, because if you are still looking for a possible Valentine's Day event, then you might want to check out the Jazz Kitchen, which is having some great concerts on Valentine's Day, including the incredible, as always, Everett Green. But you need to, like, get your reservations in now if you haven't done so already. The Jazz Kitchen would be a great place to take your sweetie to celebrate.
I love that. Oh, good food, maybe a glass of bubbly along with your meal.
Sounds very nice. You know, it's cool. They're celebrating 20 years at the Jazz Kitchen, so they actually have a lot of great things coming up over the next couple of weeks. You might want to check out their website for the full schedule.
Another intimate entertainment is at the Phoenix Theater. It's Bruce Graham's dark comedy about the haves and have-nots. It's called North of the Boulevard, and it just opened. In fact, don't tell your sweetie you got cheap seats if you're buying tickets for this weekend, but it's cheap seats weekend. You can get less expensive tickets. We'll have a playwright interview for you next week, but you can see the play before you even hear about the playwright.
Something you might want to consider as a Valentine's Day gift that anyone would love, I'm sure, are tickets to the Book of Mormon. That's right.
I would love that.
Well, I would love it, too, if anyone wants to get me
that.
That's right. Yeah, it's coming here to Indianapolis. It's going to be at the Old National Center beginning June 17th for a run. And individual tickets are on sale to the public now. And I hear they are going very fast. This is a very funny, very popular musical by the creators of South Park and Avenue Q and Spamalot and all types of other fun people that have been a part of this musical. Winner of the 2011 Grammy Award for the cast recording for that, and just a very fun show. So get your tickets now. You can get them where? If you visit bookofmormonthemusical.com, you can get the information for the Indianapolis tour.
Not to spoil it or anything, but think twice before you take young children to see the Book of Mormon.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea.
I'm just saying. I don't want to reveal the plot of this, but if your sweetie likes live theater, you might want to go see the Merrimack Players production of The Cemetery Club, presented by the Martinsville Arts Council. I seem to be on a dark comedy kick here. Sorry. It opens February 28th and runs through March 9th, Fridays and Saturdays at 8, Sundays at 2:30. It's at the Depot Theater, which is at 210 North Marion Street in Martinsville. And if you go online and enter Mary Mack, that's Merrymack Players, into a search engine, you'll get the details and how to order tickets.
Another hot ticket that is always desired here in town is the Zubilation, of course, and those tickets are on sale now as well. They have gone on sale, and so that might be a great Valentine's Day gift also to check out, especially this year with they're going to be celebrating orange and their big orangutan exhibits.
I love that.
Yeah, they're also at the zoo, they are having their call for artists right now for their naturally inspired paint out. Applications for artists are due by March 3rd if you want to be considered to participate in their 12th annual plein air event.
Lovely. If your sweetheart likes black and white large-scale photos of the glories of nature, did Ansel Adams just float into your head? Probably should have. You might want to make plans to take your sweetheart to the Ansel Adams preview party, which is on Friday, February 28th at 7:30. The exhibit doesn't open until the next day, March 1st, but you can get a sneak preview as well as a chance to get some behind-the-scenes stories and much more, as they say. The Ansel Adams Show is a collection of more than 80 of his personally chosen photographs, and they focus largely, no pun intended, focus camera, you get it?
Nice adventure.
Focus largely on the vast spaces of the American West.
It's like Matthew Soucy just walked into the studio.
No offense, Matthew, but take it back. Photos ranging from Yosemite to the Pacific Coast, the Southwest, Alaska, Hawaii, and the Northwest. Some of those not necessarily things you automatically think of when you think Ansel Adams. You can get more information on all that at idlejorg.org.
Well, I can't stop thinking of Valentine's Day things, apparently, Sharon. Something else you might want to consider if you still need a Valentine is to take your sweetie to the ISO this weekend, because they have concerts on the 14th, 15th, and 16th. And it is a Valentine's Day themed concert, Songs of Romance, including music from Romeo and Juliet, as well as Time Goes By, and lots of other great romantic songs conducted by Steve Hackman, who is the guest conductor this weekend. And they're also doing complimentary wine and popcorn samples and lots of other fun stuff. So definitely check that out as well.
And if your sweetie loves Brahms or Dvorak,
yes,
a program coming up next weekend, the 20th through the 22nd, two great sweeping romantic works. The beloved pianist Andre Watts is coming back to Indy to play the Brahms Second Concerto with the ISO, and Dvorak's Symphony No. 7. If you love the Ninth,
Yeah.
I suspect you're going to love the 7th if you don't know it already. So check that out more at IndianapolisSymphony.org.
Cool. Hey, last thing, Sharon, I just want to get in here. President's Day is coming up on Monday the 17th, and Connor Prairie is offering free admission to the Prairie on President's Day. You can play Capture the Flag, you can box with the President, meet past presidents, meet first ladies, all types of fun stuff at, of course, the Interactive Park. There's even carnival-style shooting with Teddy Roosevelt. How fun is that?
Your sweetie can walk softly and carry a big stick.
Should be a fun day up Monday at Connor Prairie.
My last item is not a dark comedy. I just would like to point out Eric Grayson is presenting Animal Crackers, continuing the Marx Brothers theme at the Garfield Park Arts Conservatory. GPACArts.org for more information. That is coming up this Saturday at 7 p.m. It's part of the monthly vintage movie night series, and lots of fun.
Very good. Okay, Sharon, we'll be back next week with more things to do on the calendar we call
What Do We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Though he lives in Michigan now, composer James Aikman was born in Indiana and studied at both Butler and IU, making him a great choice of composer for the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra to commission for their 30th anniversary. And James is fascinated by science, so the piece he wrote reflects the theme of this year's Butler Arts Fest: fables, fairy tales, and physics. Sharon Gamble invited James Aikman and ICO Executive Director Elaine Eckhart to our studios to explain.
So you have some warm feelings towards Indiana in general.
Warm feelings, indeed. No, I grew up in Indy, and at that time it was Naptown. And it was my experience that, at least when we were growing up, that, we can't wait till we grow up and get out in the world and go find something to do somewhere else. But now, it's like in the past 30, 40 years, it's really become an amazing city, and everybody says that. I meet people up in, you know, all over the place, Detroit and Ann Arbor, and they say how they just love Indy and they've been to conferences here and so forth. But my family and friends and so many teachers, colleagues, mentors live here. And once I started in, I can hardly start naming individuals because I'd leave somebody out.
It's like the Oscars. You know. We'd have to play some music to play you off the stage.
Yeah, get the hook.
I thank everyone I've ever met.
That's right. Get the gong.
That's right. You know, that's great. It's great to hear from somebody who's gone away that there is a reputation out there, because for the longest time, you'd travel somewhere and you'd say Indianapolis and the automatic response would be 500.
Exactly. Yeah, sure.
But in the last 20 or 30 years, sometimes it's Indianapolis and it's, oh, that violin competition. Oh,
absolutely.
That fabulous chamber orchestra.
Yeah.
So we're getting there bit by bit, folks. It's good to be the Avis, the number two. We're trying harder, right?
The art museum, everything. Yeah.
Yeah.
All over the place.
So, Elaine, I have to ask, or James, whichever of you is the right person to answer this. So, you knew that this piece would celebrate the history of the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra and would be part of a festival titled Fables, Fairy Tales, and Physics. One of those things is not like the other two, by the way.
Right. I know.
So where did you start with the piece, with the inspiration for the piece, and was it hard to figure out how to pull the physics part in?
Well, I didn't, in fact, worry too much about the first two and concentrate on the physics, because that's what really interested me. And initially, I just thought, upon hearing that would be the title, I thought, oh my gosh, I've got to pull in my friend Gordon Kane, who's a remarkable physicist. He's one of the leading physicists in the world. And he happens to love music, and that's how I got to know him. So I thought, oh my gosh, he's got the most wonderful book called The Particle Garden. And it's an introduction to the world of physics in our time, 15 years ago. So he would say it's not current, but it is current. And at the same time, I thought, oh my gosh, would it be possible? So I emailed him and asked if I could steal his title.
Sure.
And he said, oh my gosh, it would be, he said it would be an honor. And I'm the one who's honored, of course. But I think it's a wonderful title. That's the key. I mean, The Particle Garden, it just, there are so many correlations between composing with the notes and all the parameters that go into a piece of music, register, tone, quality, mood, tempo, everything else, much like how we're trying to discover how our actual universe works. And I remember as a kid, in fact, just looking out at an eclipse, and I thought, oh, how strange that is, because we were just looking at these little molecules, and they sort of are the same, the way they function. Anyway, I've always had a layman's interest in physics.
So for the layman, what is a particle garden? And I include myself in that, too. Okay.
It's just his title.
Is it a metaphor for how physicists try to understand
indeed, how everything grows
and
interacts and so forth.
But, okay.
Yeah.
So just to clarify the title, the work is in three movements. Mm-hmm. So the title is Triptych Musical Momentum, which of course talks about or was inspired initially about the momentum of the orchestra.
Sure.
Over a 30-year period in our appointment as orchestra in residence at the Schrott Center for the Arts. And so it tied into physics, that's part of the theme of the Arts Fest.
Once a chamber orchestra is in motion, it cannot stop being
yes,
in motion.
Yeah, the chamber orchestra in motion stays in motion. And so one of the three movements is actually entitled The Particle Garden,
right.
The middle of the three movements.
And that's a central movement. And I included with that some electronic music that is enhancing the live music and is drawn from the live music, but it's also appearing in the stereo field from the speakers, and I think it creates the particle garden, so to speak.
So how did you steep yourself in the history of the orchestra? Because you took a loosely time-based, first movement, early years, second movement, the maturation as orchestra members got to know one another better. And this is one of the, it's not a secret, but it's not as well known as it should be. The number of Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra players who have been with you since the beginning
is a third.
In the beginning.
Yeah,
and
12.
And that's amazing.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's just amazing.
Yeah.
And then your third movement, which is about going forward, the fanfare as we go into a new era. How did you learn these stories? How did you learn this history?
Well, we were having lunch, and of course, I know some of the players in the orchestra, and we'll certainly get to know more of them too. And yeah, the same, with this piece introductions of various sections. I'm introducing myself to them musically, but we were sitting at lunch, Elaine and Kirk and I, and we were discussing, and Kirk was talking about, again, the first decade of the ICO being lively and spirited, and full of the energy and pride of youth. And
a lot of young players, yeah.
Yeah, evolving, gaining flight as an ensemble, and exciting times. And then the middle decade, the second decade, is when people start getting reflective and some having children and getting to know each other's families and knowing their part in the community and so forth. And then he was reflecting how the third decade was, again, included this confident enthusiasm. And I don't know, just the ebullience of achievement and the solidity and confidence of having just created this strong, wonderful, thriving organization. And so anyway, it all deals with life experience, at least on the inspiration level.
But audience members who maybe don't know the players personally, don't know who has children and who's close, will still be able to understand this.
No.
No?
You can't understand any of it unless you know their kids.
Yeah. So I gather there'll be a little humor in this composition as well.
No humor. It's
such a brat.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
No, and I think the, you know, ending with the fanfare movement, just opens the doors for the future, or sends a message. It sends a message to everybody, where you've, whether you've been coming to the chamber orchestra for a few years, or this will be the first, maybe this is the first chamber orchestra experience, or you've been coming for the whole 29, the fanfare opens the doors to the future.
And it is a fanfare is traditionally, I looked up the Harvard Dictionary definition, actually, and it goes on for pages. But it's pretty funny that traditionally, of course, it's only brass. And then composers have added percussion. But I said, well, why not use everybody? And so that's what I was doing and have done. And the fanfarish gesture, like Elaine said, is it's a very positive one, and one that shouts to the future.
So they're going to have to add another page to the definition because of you.
Well, there
we
well
go. Done.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So is there, how interactive has this process been, or will it continue to be, because we're having this conversation several weeks ahead of the performances? Have you sat with a lot of recordings to say, oh, the oboe section is especially good at XYZ, I want to highlight that, tell us a little bit about that process. How do you write for this ensemble beyond the programmatic parts we've already talked about?
I think to be truthful, I write what the notes tell me to write and mm-hmm. what I hear, mm-hmm. and I envision, you know, the place, but not specifically the people as much. As I get to know the players and we get to know each other a bit and flourishes and so forth and individual characteristics, I don't want to single anybody out because I'll create animosity. Well, what about me?
So but, much for the particle, the peace in the particle garden. That, you're going to create chaos there.
No, not at all. Not at all.
But it has helped because you've been, over the past several months, you've been at rehearsals and concerts all the way going back to the end of last season, so mm-hmm. not just this season. So
well, sure, and I've heard the band, of course.
Yeah, and he's was already familiar with the Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra, but you know, once we had the assignment defined, you know, he could come and listen with a little more of a discriminating ear, whatever he was listening for.
Yeah,
I'm not
sure.
A composer, so you know, I'm probably hearing other things, but so that has helped.
But essentially, writing is such a wonderful field, and composing, and whenever you're thinking that you have the answer, you at times you may wake up the next morning and say something triggered something in your sleep, and you find, oh, but what if I did this? There's a certain gelling that takes place that you only know if you keep at it long enough with discipline and extraordinary, what is the word for it? It's just confidence of having the true peace come out. And there's no other way of putting it.
How do you know when? How do you know when you're done?
Well, that's a good question too, because sometimes when you're painting, of course, you put in too many colors.
And yeah.
It messed the whole thing up. You know, because for at least I know when I get there, there's a certain sparkle that hits my eye, I think, is the best way to define it, because I'm excited about it, and that's just it.
And you no longer wake up that next morning and go, oh, I could do this.
Exactly.
It stops writing itself in your dreams, it sounds like.
Once it's to the correct point, that those nudges don't keep coming.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Sharon Gamble with composer James Aikman and Indianapolis Chamber Orchestra Executive Director Elaine Eckhart. Triptych Musical Momentum is James's work that's written for the 30th anniversary of the ICO. In fact, we're hearing some of that right now. And you can hear its performance on Friday, April 11th at 7:30 p.m. at Butler's Schrott Center for the Arts. Part of the university's second annual Arts Fest, Fables, Fairy Tales, and Physics. Learn more about the festival at butlerartsfest.com and learn about James Aikman at aikmanmusic.com. That's A-I-K-M-A-N music.com. Finally, discover the ICO at icomusic.org. Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Vaselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter next week, Thursday at 8 p.m. and Saturday at 7 a.m., when I'll get a preview of the Ansel Adams Show at the Idlejour.
I'll meet Chinese artist Zhu Ming Kao.
And I'll chat with playwright Bruce Graham about his new play at the Phoenix. Plus, there'll be that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next weekend to The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.